I think I pitched to 82 investors, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say the first 40 that I talked to were primarily seed funds, right? VCs. Mm-hmm. And they all said no. Yeah, like, I was getting like straight no's, like, no, you know, to the point where I was just like,
really good for your confidence.
Oh, by yeah.
The best thing you could do for your confidence.
Oh, my gosh. So obliterated. I got totally obliterated.
Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Seed Stories. I'm John Deschowski here with my good friend, James, the founder and CEO of Therify. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you as always, and looking forward to getting into the convo.
I should have shaved for today, but I knew that you were going to have a strong beard, so yeah. I was like, "We're gonna match."
Keep the beard game proper. It's good. It looks good on you.
So, look, you obviously know I'm a biased investor and friend, and I'm a huge fan of your story. I want to go all the way back to the beginning, if you can. Paint a little picture about how you got into startups and technology for the audience, if you can.
Yeah. So, I mean, this really goes back to my family origin. You know, my parents are from Nashville, born and raised. They were born into segregation, right? The Civil Rights Act, you know, didn't pass until they were in high school, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the types of opportunities that they had growing up, very different than my life, right? And the opportunities that I now have later on. And so I think a lot of my, you know, desire to build a startup is out of a desire to establish an equity stake in this world, right? In a way that my parents, my grandparents, my ancestors didn't have the opportunity to do, right?
Yeah.
And so I was actually raised in Boston. You know, the year that I was born, my parents moved up to Boston for my dad to attend Harvard Divinity School. You know, I grew up in predominantly white neighborhoods. It was like always the only black kid. I played hockey, right? Wow. My mom was like, hockey, like, you know what I mean? Like, so she's like, foreign.
She's like, that wasn't on the list.
Right.
But we'll take it.
It's like, you don't want to play football or something?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was, you know, up until college, I decided that I wanted to go to a historically black college, you know, just to connect to a part of my identity that I hadn't had the opportunity to do so growing up. You know, went to Howard University, came out of Howard and just totally had a non-linear career path. Like, just didn't know what I wanted to do. I started out on Wall Street at Morgan Stanley. You know, at that point, kind of got the sense that I didn't really want to work in one of these big bureaucratic spaces, you know, making, you know, people who were already wealthy more wealthy. What I really wanted to do was establish that for me and my family, you know? And so that's when I started thinking about tech. You know, started out in a customer success role at an ad tech company called PubMatic. Took a detour to B school because I studied journalism. And I've always been more of a poet than a quant. I was like, if I want to build a business one day, maybe B school. And like, I should have had better advice back then. If I could go back, I would just build something.
Right.
You know,
that's interesting you say that, is like the best business school is actually just creating a company. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I've learned 10 times more building a business than, you know, no offense to business school, but, and so coming out of business school, tried to build my first company, with my co-founder, still my co-founder, Warren. It was a company called NewsCart. And so we tried to build kind of a B2B news aggregation platform that we sold to media companies in New York, like Time Inc. and Viacom. And what we ran into is that we weren't solving a big enough problem, right? I quickly learned that you have to solve a problem that is both frequent and intense. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that, you're probably not going to be able to demand the pricing that you need to have good margins. And so you know what happens when you have negative margins, right? And so, you know, we decided that we're going to take some time off, But Warren and I became best friends through that process, and we knew that we were probably going to do something together again. And so I got an enterprise sales job because I felt like, you know, one of my weaknesses, our first rodeo, was just that I didn't really know how to sell. And so I went to a company called Envision and basically started from the bottom as a business development rep, like doing lead generation, and worked my way up to selling into, you know, some of our largest customers like Microsoft, Amazon, so on and so forth. And then right before starting this company, I landed at Facebook, leading their partnerships with digital publishers like BuzzFeed and Vice in the US.
I was going to try to paint a through line through that, but I think that, yeah. One of your superpowers I've noticed is sales. And I think that, you know, startup founders can pick one of two paths, like being very strong technically or very strong in sales. And sometimes you can find somebody who's done both, but that's rare.
Yeah.
I guess that early BD role, what do you think it was about your innate skills in selling that allowed you to sort of rise the ranks over time?
Yeah. I mean, I've always been able to kind of connect with people, right? Mm-hmm. Like I like talking to people. And I've always, I think, been humble enough to say that I am going to start in this position that historically has been reserved for like 22-year-olds straight out of college, right? Mm-hmm. But here I am, you know, a 33-year-old, you know, in this role. And I think I've never been scared of learning something new and like starting at the bottom, you know?
Yeah. One of the books I give to founders early on, and I always get groans on this, is How to Win Friends and Influence People, classic book, which the title is atrocious. I wish there was like a new edition, but one of the strongest points to the book is really to obviously listen and absorb, but like give more than you get.
Yeah.
Quick detour, time at Facebook. Like this is pre-Meta.
Pre-Meta.
What was your sense of trying to work within that organization? I mean, you had been at Morgan Stanley, which was sort of like obviously an institution.
Yeah.
Facebook had become an institution, but is still innovative in certain ways. I guess what did you find about that experience that had an impact on you?
Yeah. First off, I just want to say, despite all the news stories and everything, absolutely incredible place, right? I never thought I would work at a big company again. I was like, I will never, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing about Facebook is you have some of the smartest people in the world who are also some of the most humble. Like, there are no, I don't know if I can curse on here, but there are no assholes.
Yeah, for sure. It's not for kids.
Okay.
Like my daughter watches the show sometimes, but really just to make fun of me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good show. So at Facebook, even though it is this huge company, and I, you know, I think Mark still wields a lot of kind of unilateral power in a way, it is a place where you can come up with an idea and you can build it, right? No matter what role you're in. And so I had an amazing opportunity to really build a framework for how we support digital first news organizations, right? And even partner really closely with our product teams on building products specifically for those partners, right?
Yeah.
And so Facebook is probably the only big company where I could have worked and been happy, right? Because I had the autonomy to have a, you know, very significant influence in a company that by that time was relatively mature.
We're getting close to the moment of like thinking about entrepreneurship. There's obviously the idea and then wanting to be an entrepreneur. Which one came first, chicken or the egg? Like, I know I wanted to start a business, but I don't know what I want, or I have this idea, now I have to start a business. Which way was it for you?
It was definitely, I know I want to start a business, but like, I don't know what. I feel like the problem with the first attempt and why it didn't work out was, it was just like, oh, like, this is a cool idea, you know? It wasn't like I feel some sort of deep personal connection to the problem being solved. Right. And so that's what I was looking for. I knew that I wanted to do something, but I needed to find what that connection was to my personal life. And so that's how it went, right? It was definitely wanting to do something before actually getting into it. Yeah.
And so you're at Facebook, you're looking around, and sort of the idea of Therify comes from a personal experience. Would love to have you share.
You know, I went through a really tough time, and this was around the time I was coming out of my first attempt to build a business, just with, you know, anxiety and depression, like, really bad. And at the time, like, I didn't know what was driving it, right? You know, I had seen people be depressed, had seen people be anxious, but it was like one of these things that happened on TV. Like, it didn't actually, it wouldn't happen to me. And in retrospect, what I was really going through was I had all this unresolved trauma from losing my dad to cancer at a young age. And, you know, I was 12 when he passed, and I wasn't old enough to really process what was happening. Right.
Right.
And so I went through my teens, my 20s, like, you know, I literally didn't cry about losing my dad until I was like 31. Mm. Right. And so I had been going all of my life holding all this stuff in. And then all of a sudden I couldn't keep it in anymore. Right. And so, you know, when I was going through that, I was reluctant to go to therapy. I was like, you know, I've been through worse. I'll therapy, like, nah, you know?
Yeah.
And then a close friend of mine was like, you know, I was like, I'm good. My friends were like, you're not good.
You're being a
like,
dick.
Right. Yeah. Like, get some help. And so I finally like built up the courage. Finally, it's like, all right, I'm going to try to get a therapist. And when I entered that process, it was the most frustrating thing I've ever been through. Right. Mm. Like, one, you know, I'd come out of 2 years of business school and trying to start a company. So I didn't have a lot of money, so I couldn't really afford it. And then two, just the process of like finding a therapist who really understood the nuances of my cultural experience, mm-hmm. you know, as a Black man in America was hard. You know, I went through 7 consultations before I was able to find someone who's a good fit. But what really got me was that I had so many friends and family members who went through that same thing and gave up, right?
Yeah.
And like really needed care, but couldn't get it, right?
Right.
It just infuriated me, right? And so it's interesting how, you know, some of the darkest moments that you go through can just create something special and inspire you to just like do something about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. Your experience with your father, losing him, which is so unfortunate, and then just tucking it away and being like, nah, I'm good, you know, and like needing your friends to be the alarm bell to like share this with you. The destigmatization of therapy is incredibly important. I think we call it coaches in Silicon Valley, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But this is why I really love Therify as a business, because it could be a movement, right? Yep. Like, one of the things you've shared with me is that, like, okay, first of all, it's hard for the Black community to even get proper therapy because you have to spend the first 6 sessions explaining to some white lady, like, this is what it's like to live in America.
Right.
Caring about a whole community's mental health is such a like a beautiful and authentic thing that comes across so naturally for you. You're like, okay, this is a terrible experience, a big problem, which I always tell entrepreneurs, don't be a solution in search of a problem. Find the big problem first.
Yep.
You clearly found one. What did you do next? Like, what was the next step for you?
So, you know, ironically, I didn't immediately say I'm going to start a business. Like, what I really wanted to do was just help people as quickly as possible. And so the first problem I tried to solve for was the cost problem. So actually, like, I think this was March 2019. It was my birthday. Like, the first very small thing I did was raised money from friends and family to like help people pay therapy bills. And I called it TheraFund. And like, I found some group practices in DC and like literally paid therapy bills for people. Cool. And it was through that experience though, that I realized that, you know, to the point that we talked about, there's this more pervasive problem, right? That people don't talk about enough, which is the process of finding a fit. Right.
Right.
And so from there, again, starting very small, I started a Google form, right? You know, I'm at Facebook at the time. I started this Google form where basically my friends and family can take a short self-assessment for me to get a sense of their presenting symptoms, any like demographic preferences that they have. So, you know, you can say like, I would like to see a Black woman or, you know, a South Asian man or, you know, someone who's LGBTQ plus affirming, right? And I would just manually like search and send culturally sensitive providers to my friends and family. And it just honestly, it blew up in a way that I didn't expect, right? To the point where I'm like, I have a full-time job. I'm manually matching people with therapists. And I think over like a 3-month period, I matched, you know, almost 150 people manually.
I love that.
Yeah. So that's what I was like, okay.
Yeah. I should do something with this. And also, where did all the time go? Because I'm spending all my time doing this.
Exactly. Yeah.
Those early stories, I think a lot of people who are thinking about starting a company and want to solve a problem feel so much different than the Social Network movie. It is a behind the scenes nights and weekends form document sitting in your boxer shorts.
Literally.
Yeah.
Now we're in like 2020. Now we're in like mid 2020.
Yep. So it's pandemic time.
Pandemic time.
You sort of had to come to Jesus. You're like, okay, let's go in full go on this.
Yeah.
What did sort of that moment look like? A resignation, as it were, from Facebook, finding, you know, building with your, you know, talking to your co-founder, starting to think about actually building something. Where did you go from there?
It was like a light bulb, because I was like, wow, a lot of my professional life, I've been thinking about how do I merge my purpose and my passion with my career? Like, how do I make those two things the same? And the problem was, I didn't know what my purpose or passion was. But now I'm like, okay, there's a reason why I went through what I went through, because I needed to get more proximate to the problem so I can solve it for other people. I was like, oh shit, like this is it.
This is it. Yeah.
You know? And so I remember I flew, my co-founder Warren lives in Nashville. I flew down. At the time he was at McKinsey. He was a data scientist, an engineer there. Flew down to Nashville and I was like, I need you.
It's like shaking him, right?
Like, yeah, right.
I need you.
Yes, like I need you. You know, he spent so much of his career, you know, building technology and building machine learning algorithms to improve clinical outcomes, right? And so, you know, as founders, like I just felt like we were perfect for this idea. So I convinced him to get on board. And the next challenge was just like, okay, like how are we going to leave our jobs? You know, like
how are we going to eat food?
Literally, yeah, like
pay bills.
Yeah, like because we both had good jobs and had savings, but we didn't have like a big like family safety net or anything, right?
Right.
And so basically, what I said was, if I can close a contract with if I can get someone to agree to pay for this, right? Like at this point, what is literally like a souped up Google form, you know, like I will leave Facebook. And that's exactly what happened. We got one and then ultimately two, companies to sign contracts and say like, we will, if you're able to bring this to us, we will pay for it.
This is a good moment for the elevator pitch, right? Because the approach for Therapy is a little bit, unique in that it's an enterprise set up for companies to actually pay for Black and Brown therapy for their employees. So I botched it. Your turn to do a much better version of the elevator pitch.
Yeah, no, essentially, I mean, we're an inclusive mental health benefit for employers. We help, you know, companies retain diverse talent by, you know, connecting employees to therapists from similar backgrounds and with shared experiences, right? And the whole sense is, and the whole idea is that if you create a solution, right, that is tailored to the identities of the employees that you're serving, they're going to use it more, right?
Yeah.
That was our hypothesis. And that's exactly what we're seeing play out, right? Like the average utilization rate of a corporate mental health benefit is less than 10%. Our utilization rate across all of our customers is over 30%, right?
That's amazing. And we're talking about big logos too, right?
Yeah.
Some of your early customers.
Yep. Indeed, Thumbtack. you know, Omnicom Media Group, second largest conglomerate of ad agencies in the world. So
yeah. To all the employees of those companies, if you're listening, feel free to use their font.
Hit me up.
So I want to get into sort of the next phase where things are getting real. Yeah. You guys are really starting to put the sort of, you know, pen to paper, building the company. You applied to YC.
Yep.
And were do you remember who interviewed you once you,
Sure do. So we had, you know, they basically say it's going to be like one 10-minute interview, right?
Right.
Our initial interview was 30 minutes. And then we had, I think we had four additional interviews after that.
Oh my gosh.
And it was primarily Michael. Yeah. Michael Seibel.
Yeah. He takes it really easy on founders, I've heard.
Oh yeah. It's the easiest interviews you'll ever go through. Exact opposite. It was deep, you know, but I think they were really trying to assess like how big can this be? Right. I think Michael's thing in particular was, you know, we initially were pitching ourselves as kind of a Black and Latinx solution, which is our kind of emphasis and what we know and understand best. But I think there was a sense that it can be much bigger than that, right?
Right.
And I think, you know, Michael in particular wanted some assurance that we were thinking bigger than that, right?
Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and the reality is that's true. Like if you can definitely build a bespoke service for a niche community, I mean, that is startups through and through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Airbnb started off with a very niche product and service, you know, bringing breakfast to people on blow up mattresses. And obviously we know what it is today. So like, if you can do a really good job early on and get a, you know, 3 times higher utilization rate, as you mentioned, for that just means you have a better product and service.
Right.
So you go through the batch. I don't want to like dot over that. What was your North Star metric during that time, and what were you really hoping to achieve by demo day?
Yeah. The North Star metric was paid pilots, right? Like we wanted to establish a foundation on which we could learn, right? We could build the product. We could get a sense of, you know, what was working and what wasn't working, how we could better serve our customers so that we could scale up from there in a way that is going to be successful and, you know, lead to the goal of product market fit. And so I think our goal was 5 paid pilots. By demo day, we got to 4. And then the other thing that we were looking at that we still look at to this day is utilization of the services, right? Like we're not like, yes, we're building a business and that is really important to us, but this is also like very personal. And I actually want people to use Therify, right? And it's interesting. You look at some of like the business models in the space. There is some misalignment where it's like, depending on your business model, you make more money if people don't use your service.
Right.
But that's not how we really think about it. Right. We think that both things can exist. You can impact people in a very powerful way, and you can also build a business.
One thing I brushed over was the fact that you were accepted into YC, which is only 6% of, of the batch is Black founders. So like, that was like a massive milestone in and of itself. What was your experience like after that? Was there sort of like a sense that you were getting any additional oversight, or there was a sense that you were sort of like being cared for, or was it like Michael is still just as hard as you as everybody else?
That's a really good question. I didn't feel like I was treated any differently, right? Michael was one of my partners. Tim, as well as Diana, were my partners as well. And it was interesting. I grew up being, you know, one of the only Black folks in most environments, so it didn't feel too different for me.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a certain like imposter syndrome that comes with it sometimes, though. Of like being the only one, and you know, obviously wanting more Black founders to have the same opportunity that I did. And so feeling the pressure of like, you know, wanting to perform and, you know, wanting to be impressive so that other people who look like me can have the same opportunity. And so that's something that I thought about. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm glad that I wasn't treated any differently. Like, the world is not going to give me like some sort of extra help because I'm Black, clearly.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so I think if that had been the case, you know, if Michael were the type to do that, he would have been putting me at a disadvantage, you know?
We're getting close to demo day. You're starting to think about what you want to raise. Yeah. Your sweat is dripping off of your forehead. You know, you're like, gotta like actually perform here.
Yeah.
What did you start with first? Did you start with the deck? Did you start with the list? Like, what was the sort of like thought process on like how much you wanted to raise, all of those kinds of things?
Yeah. So I started with, as you know, what YC calls kind of the vertebrae, right? So like, what are the 3 to 5 points, right? That you really want to drive home with investors, right? So I think for us, it was, I think it was team, right? Because my co-founder and I, you know, I guess we're unique in the fact that we were Black founders who, you know, were coming from Facebook and in McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
Traction, right? The fact that we'd quickly, you know, kind of closed these paid pilots with, you know, impressive logos. And I think it was also like business model and market size, right? Just a massive opportunity within mental health. And so...
Proven, yeah. I remember proven sort of like unicorn pluses, right? Who are just sort of scratching the surface, but weren't delivering anything close to what you guys were.
Yeah.
So that, I remember that being a big component of the pitch as well.
Yeah. Yep. And yeah, like our utilization rates relative to, you know, industry benchmarks. And so that allowed us then to think about how to structure the deck, right? And it was like, you know, our deck was so simple, you know, like prior to YC, I would have had like, you know, just page like 20 pages of like stuff that probably the average investor wouldn't read. And YC reminded me that like the point of your deck is to get a meeting. Right.
Yeah. It's the trailer of the movie. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. You know? And so, once we had the deck together, then we started putting together a list. And this is where I would have done things totally different. I think I pitched to 82 investors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the first 40 that I talked to were primarily seed funds, right? VCs. Mm-hmm. And they all said no. Like, I was getting like straight no's, like no, you know, to the point where I was just like,
really good for your confidence.
Oh yeah,
the best thing you could do for your confidence.
Oh my gosh, so
obliterated.
I got totally obliterated, right? And I think, in retrospect, you know, I would have treated fundraising like I treat building a business, which is like, learn what's working and what's not working as quickly as possible, like A/B test, right? Things, and then optimize, right? And so what I ultimately found out was that, you know, we were doing great with angels, right? Like my conversion rate with angels was like, you know, probably 75%, where for seed funds, it was like, you know, zero. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like we ultimately ended up getting a couple of funds to invest. But I would have prioritized angels, you know, like I would have gotten 50K there, 75 there. And I would have been, you know, perfectly successful at getting the amount of money that we needed. But I wasted so much time with seed funds. I think, you know, and I'm not the investors, but I think there was this concern that like the market was so crowded, and because the market is so crowded that they just needed more data. They wanted to see us further along. Right. And it just was too much risk to jump in at that. Yeah. I don't know if that was the truth, but what, you know, my conversations with angels, you know, was just, you know, they were able to make quick decisions. You know, a lot of our angels felt a personal connection to what we were building, and I would have just doubled down on angels. Yeah,
and I think that's great advice for founders, especially going into VC meetings. I think that there's a little bit of a black box in sort of what venture capitalists decide and how they decide what their process is, despite what they tell you.
Right.
And angels that like can have a pretty binary response really quickly to what your company is. And I think with your business, I think for all the angels that I know that invested, myself included, there was this sort of like, we've been founders before, mental health, take my money, please, experience, you know, like, and obviously just understanding the size of the problem, but then also feeling your passion come through, despite you had been denied by 40 previous investors.
I was like, this is going to look great for all the future investors. Yeah.
You're still there. And I remember distinctly having this conversation with you, and I was like, okay, he's still hustling so hard. I also want to make sure that he's doing okay. And so I remember mandating that you start to exercise and eat right, because I was like, I can see a little bit of myself in him who's going to just go to the end of the earth to do whatever it takes. What was the headline number?
1.3 was our seed round.
Awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. On the fun side, Looking Glass Capital out of New York, SoftBank Opportunity Fund, which is a fund that SoftBank has set aside specifically to invest in Black and Latinx founders and Indigenous founders as well. You, Jack Altman from Lattice, you had the chief HR officer at PayPal, Ellen Pao, former CEO of Reddit, and a bunch of other just really fantastic angels that I think are going to be really helpful.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Yeah. Major milestone. But then also time to get back to work, as always.
Yeah.
I always like to end on, what does the next 12 months and 10 years look like for you?
Next 12 months, we're going to have thousands of lives covered, right, under Therify, and just extend our impact via employers. In 10 years, though, this is much bigger than employers, right? This is about really shifting the culture in terms of the way that people think about mental health, especially within underserved communities. And I'll tell you a quick story to kind of bring this home. We did customer interviews recently with several of our members, and this one guy told us that Therify saved his relationship, right? Mm. Black guy, he said that beginning of the pandemic, him and his girlfriend were going through it, right? Things were not going well, and he was scared, right? Because he wants to marry this girl, right? And he doesn't want to lose her in the middle of the pandemic. And so his girlfriend basically tells him, look, if you want this thing to continue, we need to see a therapist, right? But it's on you, right, to find it. And on top of that, you need to find someone, you need to find a Black woman specifically, right, who will understand our Black relationship. So he goes to his company and is like, do you have anything I can use to find a therapist? His company says, yes, we have this platform called Therify. All you got to do is tell them a little bit about what you want, and they'll match you with someone who will be a perfect fit for you and your girlfriend, right? So he does this, he gets matched in less than a day, him and his girlfriend. They start therapy with a Black woman in California. And he says a few weeks, after starting therapy, him and his girlfriend are literally on cloud nine.
Mm.
Right? Therapy has become a regular part of their routine. And he says, it's as simple and as easy for us as going for a morning walk.
Wow. Right?
And so imagine, this is what we think about. Imagine if all 7 billion people on this planet felt that way. If seeking support was as easy and normal as just going for a morning walk, right?
That is amazing.
That is the part of the change that we want to create. And there will be other people involved too, right?
Yeah.
But we're going to be a big part of that culture shift in that movement.
That's beautiful. And look, I, as you know, huge supporter, and the future is so bright for you, James, and Therify. And it was just a real delight to spend time with you and have you on the show. And thanks again for being on.
I appreciate you, John. Let's do it again for sure.
All right. Take care.
Cool.